Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 6, 2017, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a courthouse steps decision telephone on Advocate Healthcare v. Stapleton, a decision handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Eric Baxter, Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. I will turn it over to Eric to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Eric. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and it's always a pleasure to work with you in the Federalist Society. As Laura mentioned, the discussion today is on the ruling that came out in Advocate Healthcare Networks versus Stapleton. In an opinion written by Justice Kagan, the court made pretty short work of what the parties had made out to be a fairly complicated statutory interpretation case. And after reading her opinion, I had to wonder how it was that three courts of appeals all could have gotten the case so wrong. The case involves ERISA and the church plan exemption. When ERISA was first enacted in the 1970s, Congress created an exemption for any plans that were established and maintained by a church. And a few years after ERISA was enacted, a couple of orders of nuns wrote a letter to the IRS seeking confirmation that their health care and pension plans for hospitals that they ran were exempt under the church plan exemption, and were somewhat surprised when IRS responded that they were not exempt because the orders were not considered a church, because they did not focus on providing sacerdotal functions or conducting worship services. This created quite a bit of concern in the religious community, as not only as churches began to wonder if the IRS was going to, how the IRS was going to decide what groups were churches and which religious groups were not churches, but also because it brought to light another problem, in that many religious organizations had pension boards that operated independently of the church itself. For example, especially in non-hierarchical church traditions, many small churches would band together and create an independent pension board that would establish and maintain the pension plans for the combined employees of all of the church groups. Or often churches would just establish, or religious organizations or churches would establish internal committees to manage their pension funds. Sometimes those were independent committees. And so the IRS ruling raised the concern whether any of these plans would be exempted under the church plan exemption, because they technically were not established or maintained by a church. As a result of that problem that the IRS letter brought to light, in 1980, Congress amended ERISA to expand the church plan exemption. And it did so by saying that plans established and maintained by a church included plans maintained by a principal purpose organization, was the phrase the court used. The statute actually says by any organization, the principal purpose of which is to administer or fund a plan for employees of a church or a church affiliate. The case was brought as a class action on behalf of the employees of the hospitals, three different hospitals, two associated with the Catholic Church or Catholic dioceses, and one associated with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And the class argument was that because the amendment only used the phrase include in the exemption plans that were maintained by a principal purpose organization, that there still remained a requirement that the plan, that those plans had to be originally established by a church. And the parties spent a great deal of time in their briefs arguing about the complexity of this statutory question. If if plans established and maintained by a church include only plans maintained by a principal purpose organization, did that mean that they still had to have been originally established by a church? And Justice Kagan had no problem saying that the establishment requirement was no longer in effect. Basically, this she said, you know, we start as we always do with the plain language of the case, and the phrase includes is not to be taken literally. So if she said, if you have a statute that says that the term state includes Puerto Rico and D.C., that does not mean, of course, that Puerto Rico and D.C. are in fact states. It just means that those entities would be treated like a state. And she said, this is a case of simple logic. If A is exempt and A includes C, then C is also exempt. So she said that the establishment condition simply drops out of the picture. There had been a hypothetical in the briefs that had gained quite a bit of attention at oral argument. The class argued that if you had a statute that gave free life insurance to individuals who were disabled and a veteran, and it was amended to say that individuals who are disabled and veterans shall include a person who served in the National Guard, no one would think that non-disabled National Guardsmen would get the life insurance benefit. Kagan's response to that example is that one good example does not a general rule make. And she said that if you read that example just on its plain language, then you would have to give the benefit to a National Guardsman even if he had not been injured, because the phrase injured and a vet includes a National Guardsman on its face literally would include all National Guardsmen. But she said that that example was not illustrative of the broader interpretation principle, because there were, in that particular example, it was obvious from the context that the injury and the service were two separate and independent requirements to getting the benefit. And it would be implausible for anyone to think that if you had served in the National Guard, you would get the benefit without having also been injured. She said a better example would be one where the two conditions were closely related and didn't necessarily have an independent function. For example, she said a person who enlisted and served in the active armed forces shall include a person who served in the National Guard. There, you would not argue that the person could only get the benefit if they had first enlisted in the active armed forces and then later served in the National Guard. And she pointed out that the established and maintained requirement was more like the enlisted and served requirement than the disabled example that the class had given. And she pointed out that, you know, establishing a plan under ERISA is not really a substantively significant event. It doesn't matter who establishes the plan. The purpose of ERISA is to regulate the maintenance of the plan to ensure that it remains solvent and that the rights of the participants in the plan are protected. And so by bringing in plans that were protected or maintained by a principal purpose organization, it was clear that Congress meant to include all of those and not just those that had originally been established by a church and then later maintained by an independent board. And she also pointed out how both parties' narratives of the purpose for the amendment supported the court's conclusion. The hospital's narrative was that Congress was concerned about the IRS deciding which organizations were churches and which ones were not. And she said that our construction resolves that problem to a T. And she noted that if the established requirement were still in place, that you had to first be established by a church, it would put the IRS in the business of deciding what is and is not a church, and by definition that would have disfavored church affiliates as opposed to those established by, you know, quote, whatever the IRS has decided is a church, close quote. So although the court did not go into great depth about why letting the IRS do that would be a problem, it clearly signaled that it saw something wrong with turning over to the IRS to decide whether nuns who run hospitals are part of the Catholic Church or not. And that was a principal point that we had argued in our brief, that it really would be a problem under the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause if the IRS or another government agency were to decide, pick and choose which religious organizations were sufficiently religious to constitute a church. The class's argument had been that the real purpose of the amendment was just to bring in the external pension boards. But Justice Kagan noted that the pension boards arose under a variety of different circumstances. Some were pension plans maintained by pension boards, sometimes were established by a church and then transferred to a pension board. But sometimes they were established originally by the pension board and kept by the pension board. And so the class's argument would have been both goal-defying in cutting out those pension boards that originally established their plans. So it would be both goal-defying, she said, not to mention text-defying. So the opinion is an excellent example of the power of sound textual interpretation. I believe that shortly after Justice Scalia's death, one of the tributes, Justice Kagan pointed out how Scalia had really reoriented the courts to focusing on the text and to straight textual interpretation. And she made clear in the opinion that that was what she was doing, was really sticking to the text and even citing Scalia's treatise with Brian Garner on statutory construction. And the power of that, I think, is illustrated in Justice Sotomayor's concurrence. The opinion was unanimous, 8-0 without Gorsuch's participation. But Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurrence in which, interestingly, she wrote that the statutory text compels the result. But then she goes on to say, but the legislative history does not clearly endorse it, and then mentions that even if it had, it's not clear that Congress would do the same thing today that it did in the amendment in 1980, which is a fairly interesting take on statutory construction, where she felt even though she agreed that the text clearly compelled the result and she had really no refutation of Justice Kagan's analysis, that she felt the need to point out that the legislative history did not necessarily support it or make it clear, and that she wasn't sure that Congress would do the same thing today. And so I think she felt that perhaps maybe explains how the lower courts got it so wrong, was an urge to find a problem while ignoring the clear textual meaning. The opinion is also important in that the church, you know, obviously the hospitals were protected, and the church, you know, the opinion strikes a blow in favor of religious freedom, the right of religious organizations to organize as they see fit to carry out their missions and to engage in a broad range of activities that support their religious missions and doesn't confine them, rather than confining them to the four walls of the sanctuary and worship services. The opinion does leave open the possibility that the lawsuits could continue. There's a couple of questions. In order to be a principal purpose organization, you have to be controlled by or associated with the church. The statute provides that requirement will be met if you have common religious bonds and convictions with the church. But Justice Kagan notes in a footnote that that question was not before the court, and whether these particular hospitals have the requisite common religious bonds and convictions was a question that could be litigated further. And also the question of whether the outside boards are principal purpose organizations, that is, whether they're truly focused principally on funding and administering benefit plans for church employees or employees of church affiliates, was also an open question. So there's a sense that, you know, these cases could go back down and still be litigated, but they're going to be a much harder win now for the plaintiffs, because in all likelihood, and in these cases, there's in fact pretty good evidence that all these hospitals share, you know, the religious bonds and convictions of the churches that they're associated with, that they adopt their codes, for example, of ethics, and that they have, that their pension boards are principally focused on funding and administering their pensions. But in all, a great decision both for statutory construction and for religious liberty. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, we'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our first question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, June 7th. That call will be another Courthouse Steps Decision Teleforum, this one on Impression Products v. Lexmark International, a patent case that came out last week. Featuring Professor Adam Mossoff, Director of Academic Programs and Senior Scholar at the George Mason University, Mr. Stephen Tepp, President and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide, and the moderator, Professor Christine Osenga, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federalist Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. I'll make another call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I guess I'll ask one of my own. So does this decision end litigation, or will litigation against hospitals continue?
So there have been a whole series of lawsuits filed against hospitals around the country, and they could continue in a variety of ways. As I mentioned, they could go back on some of the questions under the exemption itself, whether the hospitals have the requisite relationship with their affiliated churches, whether their pension boards are principally focused on funding and administering the pension plans. And another issue that, you know, has, I guess, been a little bit overlooked is there's, you know, the class made a pitch that, well, if you exempt all these organizations, you know, many of them have become very large organizations. They employ thousands of employees. They compete with other non-exempt entities and so forth. And that it's unfair to the employees who may be unprotected if you exempt them from ERISA. But in reality, the states, just because ERISA does not apply, that also means that there's no federal preemption, so states are free to regulate, and states, in fact, have regulated in a number of ways these organizations. And so it's very possible that lawsuits in general could continue under state law, as well as under the questions that remain within the church plan exemption itself.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I'll just end again with, I think it's a great opinion. It's actually a very short read, and it's a good... Justice Kagan has a really excellent style where she writes at a level that's approachable for lawyers and non-lawyers alike, and does a great job, is a great example of a clean statutory interpretation that also has the added benefit of protecting religious organizations.
Great. I'll make one final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. And with that, we'd like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.